Talking History. On News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the city-state of Boston in the 17th century and how it became an Atlantic power. The enormous Soviet house in Moscow, where communist true believers lived in before being brought to their deaths. The life of the African-American writer who changed the face of Western politics and culture. Donegal, Derry and the border during the revolutionary decade. And finally, to end the show, we'll bring you the extraordinary story of how Russian intelligence used technology to steal American secrets in the 1970s and the hunt to find out who is to blame. Last week, we debated the life and legacy of Jenny Wise Power, the remarkable woman whose career spanned the Land League to the winning of Irish independence. And if you want to listen back to that show, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. But first, the city-state of Boston. A groundbreaking history of early America shows how Boston built and sustained an independent city-state in New England before becoming part of the new United States. Peeling away the layers of myth surrounding a revered city, it offers a startlingly fresh understanding of America's history. The book is called The City-State of Boston, The Rise and Fall of an Atlantic Power, 1630 to 1865. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press and costs £30 sterling, so about €34. The author is Mark Peterson. And Mark, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you, Patrick. I'm pleased to be here.
Mark, what I loved about the book was that it moves away from those cliches about a city on a hill or the cradle of liberty and gives us a very different take about Boston over these centuries.
Yes, well, that was one of my aims. I lived in the Boston area for a long time and really became aware of how much those cliches get in the way of understanding a good deal of Boston's early history. And particularly the way they insistently place that history as essentially prefiguring the coming of the United States, which would have been a quite shocking, unthinkable idea to the actual people who lived in early Boston.
So instead, the model was the European city-states, and that's what they were basing it on when it was founded.
That's right. And in fact, this isn't just an invention of mine. It was quite conscious on the part of Boston's founders and evident in their records. So, for instance, one of the striking features I found in many of the documents from Boston's foundings was the way that they looked to both biblical and classical models. For instance, the city of Philippi in Macedonia that was founded by Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, but which was also later a Roman colony, and then the first place in Europe that St. Paul brought the gospel from its origins in the East, in Asia. And so this idea of sort of transfer of religion and culture and of building a new city and its surrounding hinterland was clearly present in the minds of the people who founded Boston. And their aim was essentially to do for North America what Paul and the apostles were doing in bringing Christianity into Europe for the first time.
How did the city-state develop then? And in terms of its trading relationships, what was the place of slavery? Because there were very few slaves in Boston or in New England, but yet it seems what's described as a bargain with slavery that's made.
That's right. Well, so Boston was unusual as an English colony in the 17th century in that it was really given a very tiny plot of land for its charter. Many of the early English colonies, like Virginia, for instance, were awarded by the crown huge tracts of land and then made their economies out of developing them in terms of staple agriculture, tobacco, obviously, in the case of Virginia. And by contrast, Massachusetts was granted this small sort of strip of land, about 40 miles wide from north to south, and so they didn't have the agricultural base of places like Virginia. The land was nowhere near as fertile, the growing season was shorter, and so early on, Boston's merchants, and many of the founders were merchants, realized that if the colony was to survive at all, they had to strike out and develop trading relationships with other richer places around the Atlantic. And for good and for ill, they were fortunate in that the colony of Barbados began its enormous boom in the production of sugar, which was, of course, produced by brutally enslaved African laborers, really right at the time that Boston and Massachusetts were looking for some kind of economic opportunity. And so essentially, starting from the middle of the 1640s, only a decade into the founding of the colony, Boston merchants begin gathering the, you know, relatively modest goods that New Englanders were producing, like salted meat and Indian corn and timber, barrel staves, and finding a market for them in the West Indies, and Barbados was first, because the plantation owners there essentially used every inch of land they could for the growing of sugar, and therefore imported all of these cheap goods from New England in order to feed their slaves and make the barrels that shipped the molasses and housing the slaves and using timber for firewood, etc. So really, right from the very beginning, there's this symbiotic relationship between Boston's prosperity as a trading colony and the existence of these West Indian slave economies. And so part of what the book tries to do is to trace that story of the bargain with slavery, which I refer to as a kind of original sin in Boston's history, from its beginnings all the way through the time of America's Civil War.
And that leads to something that I found really a fascinating argument in the book, and that is when it comes to the creation of the United States. Boston had become this great Atlantic power. It had these connections with the West Indies and Europe and vast trading networks. Was it a mistake to become part of the United States for New England to join as one of the colonies, given that it was to fall under the influence of the southern slave owners then?
Right. Well, that is what I think is one of the more innovative arguments in the book. Obviously, on one hand, the relationship of Boston to the rest of the colonies was necessary or was mandated by the rebellion against the crown. That is, in 1775, when war begins between Bostonians and the king's soldiers, the idea that New England needed the other colonies to join in the fight in order to, you know, be able to withstand the great forces of Britain's military power made that alliance among the colonies seem pretty essential. And for the time of the war itself and for the first few years of independence, that's essentially what the United States was, an alliance among individual colonies with very little in the way of overarching central government. And this is what changes with the U.S. Constitution. And what I'm arguing is that the decision of Boston and Massachusetts to ratify that constitution and join in a much more consolidated union with the rest of the states really did undermine the autonomy that they had developed. So, for instance, while they had been colonies of Britain, yes, Boston had this powerful trade relationship with Barbados and Jamaica and Antigua and, you know, the other slave-based colonies, but those colonies had no political power over Boston and Massachusetts. They were just sort of spokes emanating from the same hub in Britain. But under the U.S. Constitution, majorities rule, right? And so the problem that Boston very quickly discovered was that it wasn't that difficult for the southern states, Virginia being the largest of them, with their voting power augmented by the infamous three-fifths clause that added to the representation of states with large slave holdings, it meant that those colonies, now states, could make legislation for the entirety of the nation that Bostonians could not prevent from happening. So in that sense, they really are sort of under the thumb of a slave power in the way that they never had been while they were British colonies.
And finally, the fact that you're able to go from the 17th century to the middle of the 19th century gives you a scope that many historians don't have. And do you think that enables you to see different trends or maybe to see things in a different way?
Well, I do think that's one of the advantages of the book, that experts in each of the different time periods would be familiar with some of the stories that I'm telling as I go along. But people who focus on, say, the founding of Massachusetts, the 1630s and 40s, don't tend to pay much attention to the coming of the Civil War in the 1840s and 50s. And yet by looking across that whole time span, I can see that, you know, the issues surrounding, for instance, slavery, like there's a case in the 1640s where some early Boston merchants, the first ones to be trying to trade on the coast of Africa, end up attacking an African village and stealing some Africans from there and enslaving them in Boston. And so the question becomes in Boston, was that legitimate? What should we do? And the government, the general court, decides that really that was illegal and the slaves should be shipped back. Well, skip forward two centuries, and exactly the same questions are in play in the 1850s when escaped slaves from the South are flocking to Boston because Massachusetts has, of course, abolished slavery, and the federal government is insisting that no, fugitive slaves have to be returned to their masters. And so in the 1850s, exactly the same questions about what you do with illegally enslaved people, should you return them, should they remain here, who gets to decide, are being replayed. And it's striking to me that there's even a kind of physical repetition, almost a kind of performance, so that the street in Boston, State Street, that leads from the old center of government down to the wharf, is exactly the place where this crisis gets played out. And the slave who is being marched, his name is Anthony Burns, from the courthouse down to the waterfront to be shipped back to the city is surrounded by huge crowds, and the U.S. Marines are trying to keep the peace in the face of a potential riot. And the space where that takes place is exactly the place where the Boston Massacre had occurred in March of 1770, another confrontation between an angry crowd and heavily armed soldiers. So one of the things that the book is trying to do is sort of accentuate the way in which history itself plays the changes on past events and even the spaces where those take place, and the meaning of events develops and gets more thickly layered over time. And so both the function on a small space like a city or a city-state and the long chronology of the argument helps readers, I hope, see that sort of development.
Well, Mark, congratulations on the book. It's called The City-State of Boston, The Rise and Fall of an Atlantic Power, 1630 to 1865. It's published in hardback by Princeton University Press and costs about €34. The author, Mark Peterson. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been a pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book tells the chilling true story of an enormous Moscow apartment building where Soviet leaders and their families lived until hundreds of these Bolshevik true believers were led one by one to prison or to their deaths in Stalin's purges. The book is called The House of Government. It's published in paperback by Princeton University Press and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author is Yuri Slezkin. And Yuri, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So can you tell us what exactly was the House of Government?
Well, it was a huge building in Moscow across the river from the largest church in Russia, the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, and diagonally across the river from the Kremlin. It was built during the first five-year plan, the period of industrialization in the Soviet Union between 1928 and 1932. And it was meant for high government and party officials. It was the largest building in Europe at the time. It had 505 family apartments and a wide range of facilities, including a barbershop and a beauty salon and a solarium, cafeteria, kindergarten, a polyclinic, and rooms for orchestra rehearsals, and so on and so forth. Several dozen rooms, the gym, the bank, a telegraph, and so on.
It sounds like an absolutely wonderful place to live, except it wasn't. Tell me about the people who ended up there.
Well, as I said, it was meant for high government officials, and those were the people who lived there. Most of them were so-called old Bolsheviks, original revolutionaries who joined the Bolshevik Party sometime before the revolution and then rose through the ranks. Various so-called people's commissars, means basically ministers in the Soviet Union, and deputy commissars and Red Army commanders and secret police officials, socialist, realist writers, Marxist-Leninist scholars, the composer who wrote the Soviet national anthem, the chemist who embalmed Lenin's body, Stalin's relatives, Lenin's bodyguards, and many, many other luminaries.
And what was life like for them there when they were staying there?
Well, it was luxurious by Soviet standards. They had relatively large apartments, fairly small kitchens, because the idea was that they would eat in the cafeteria downstairs, although virtually no one did. And they mostly took advantage of the gym, the grocery store, and other facilities. There were large families living in those apartments. So they were meant for government officials, but of course included their families, wives, children, and various poor relations, or quite a few of those. So those were mostly extended families following their high party members around until they ended up in that building, which was officially known as the House of Government. It was meant for government members. It was the best, most comfortable, most luxurious apartment building in the Soviet Union. It was not considered beautiful, though. No one really thought of it as beautiful. And the decision was made after it had been completed that nothing like it would ever be built again. Because the original idea was to create a sort of prototype for communist domesticity. They decided this wasn't going to be it. But there it was. There was still the largest, the most comfortable, the most desirable, the most strategically located residential building in the Soviet Union.
So tell me how it became, in a sense, a kind of a haunted house. Tell me about those who were brought out then to be sent to one of the camps, the gulags, or who were brought out to be executed. How did it become then a place then that got tied up with the purges?
Well, since the so-called responsible leaseholders, people who were assigned to particular apartments within the House of Government were high government officials. They fell victim to the so-called Great Terror of 1937-38, which targeted to a considerable extent high party officials. So since that building had the highest concentration of those in any residential building in the Soviet Union, it ended up having the highest concentration of terror victims. And so during those 2 years, on almost every night, black cars would arrive, come to a stop in one of the three courtyards, and the building was organized around three courtyards with fountains in the middle. And NKVD or secret police agents would mount the stairs or take the elevator into one, two, or more apartments, and arrest those officials and all the others in every entryway would be sitting there listening, hoping it wasn't their turn. Sometimes they would enter an apartment secretly using their own keys. But there were cargo elevators in some of the kitchens, so some of them would arrive using those. One woman I talked to remembered being awakened by someone in the middle of the night opening her eyes and seeing a pale face right above hers. And it was a secret policeman who had entered the apartment quietly. And they whispered to her, "Is that your husband next to you?" And she said, "Yes." And so they said, "Wake him up. He is under arrest." There are lots of stories of all kinds, different ways in which people were arrested, mostly at night. They would bring witnesses, mostly neighbors, again, who were hoping they wouldn't be arrested themselves the following night. And altogether, over, I don't remember the exact number now, but over 800 people from that building ended up arrested, exiled, or placed in orphanages if they were children whose parents had been arrested and had no one to take them in.
Okay, Yuri, it's a chilling story. The book is called The House of Government. It's published in paperback by Princeton University Press and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author, Yuri Slezkin. And Yuri, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Well, you're welcome. It was my pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. A new book celebrates the personal and political life of the great African-American writer James Baldwin, a writer who changed the face of Western politics and culture. The book is called James Baldwin, Living in Fire. It's published in hardback by Pluto Books and costs £20 sterling, so about €23. The author is Bill Mullen. And Bill, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you, Patrick. It's wonderful to be here and thank you for having me on.
Can I ask you a general question about the life and maybe the work of James Baldwin for people who might not be familiar with him in this country, but they probably have heard of the movie If Beale Street Could Talk, which was a critical hit last year. They're probably familiar with some of the other novels, even though they mightn't connect it with Baldwin. Who exactly was James Baldwin?
I mean, James Baldwin was the first African-American writer to become a major public intellectual in the post-war period and to celebrate the lives of gays and lesbians in African-American writing. His novel, Giovanni's Room, from 1956, is a groundbreaking piece of both African-American writing and gay and lesbian life. In 1963, he threw himself into the civil rights movement, both as an activist and as a writer, and published a book called The Fire Next Time, which was his manifesto and demand for civil rights and what quickly became Black Power. And by the end of the 1960s, he was a friend and champion of the Black Panther Party, and one of the leading African-American critics of the Vietnam War, as you mentioned earlier. In the 1970s, he became one of the leading African-American advocates for Palestinian liberation, all the while continuing to write both fiction and nonfiction books, each one of which was a major advance in the chronicling of Black life in particular. And in the 1970s and early 80s, his last books really delved deeply into the lives of gay African-American men. And at a time when really virtually no one else of public note was doing this kind of work. And he was also himself a very stern and visible critic of the American state. His FBI file runs to 1,800 pages. He was under constant surveillance beginning around 1961. He was speaking publicly on behalf of, in support of the Cuban Revolution. By the late 1960s, he was one of the leading critics of what we've come to call mass incarceration in the United States. And you mentioned mass incarceration, meaning the disproportionate arrest and imprisonment of Black men. And you mentioned If Beale Street Could Talk, which was a book that was actually inspired by a very close friend of his, an African-American named Tony Maynard, who was falsely accused of murder. And Baldwin spent years working in behalf of his defense, and he was finally exonerated. But it was that experience of seeing the judicial system and racial profiling up close, which actually motivated Beale Street, which, as your viewers and readers may know, is this beautiful story about a young Black couple whose lives are semi-destroyed when the Black man is falsely accused of rape. So he was a panoramic Renaissance intellectual and a lifelong activist, and for many black writers of the period since the 1980s, when he passed, he's the touchstone that writers go back to. Toni Morrison said, in effect, that, you know, her writing was dependent heavily on his voice. And if you read Toni Morrison closely, you can hear the echoes of James Baldwin. So he was many things to many people.
Although Baldwin died in 1987, he became a symbol and an icon for the Black Lives Matters movement. And in some ways, his work even predicted it.
Yeah, I mean, he says several things across the course of his life about the role of the police in black communities, which, of course, was the focus of the Black Lives Matter movement. It was the response, the mass response to mass arrests and imprisonment and police killings of black men in particular, which really motivated that movement. And Baldwin said when his first kind of moment of political consciousness came when he was 10 years old, he was running across the streets of Harlem, and police came and just knocked him to the ground and mocked him. And he said it was a life-changing experience. In the 1960s, he called the police an occupying force in black neighborhoods from Harlem to Detroit. And he was using the language of war to describe the conditions under which black people lived and that the police were there to effectively assure that black people could never resist the conditions of their own repression. And then I mentioned Beale Street, which is a direct critique of the prison system in the United States. The magnificent Angela Davis was a very close friend of his, and she was arrested in 1971 and accused of, in effect, treason for supporting the Black Panther Party. And Baldwin came to her defense and said, wrote a beautiful letter saying, we must stand with you in prison because your life is our life. So I think from in the 50s and the 60s, before we had Black Lives Matter, James Baldwin was a critical voice in bringing attention to racism and police racism and police violence. And all of these works of his and all of these writings of his have been recovered by Black Lives Matter activists who have really realized him as a forerunner and almost an oracle of the movement.
He was also a champion of LGBTQ rights, and you see there that the struggle there for rights and for recognition was something that was a major passion for him.
It was, and it was expressed for him through his writing. I mentioned Giovanni's Room, and many of his novels. Another Country, which was published in 1962, is a very deep exploration of both gay and bisexual love between men and men and women. It was absolutely groundbreaking. And in fact, it was declared an obscene novel and was one of the reasons that the FBI hounded him. And yet he was using literature as a hammer to kind of break open a discussion about what it meant to be queer in America. In the late 1960s, he was actually vilified for this by Eldridge Cleaver of the Black Panther Party, who famously said, you know, to be black and gay is to really accommodate yourself to the white man and to racism. And he had to contend with that, and he had to fight back. And he did it in a variety of ways. Part of it was exile. He lived a good part of his life in the 1960s in Istanbul, where he felt, in a certain way, I think, more comfortable as a openly gay man. He moved more easily through society. He didn't have to encounter repression there, but he also threw himself into directing some groundbreaking gay and lesbian theater in Istanbul in the late 1960s. So his reach as a gay rights activist was really global. And similarly, when he was in Paris and in France, he was constantly propelling himself out into the public arena as a gay man who had to be reckoned with. And this was threatening. This was threatening to the state, but it was also something that was like an underground current, visible and audible to gays and lesbians in the United States, who understood him as a voice that had to be reckoned with. So I think at almost all levels of U.S. society and even global society in the post-war period, he was a bellwether of what was possible. And I would just say, just like he's been recuperated by the Black Lives Matter movement for his critique of racial profiling and police violence, I mean, we now have whole fields of scholars in the academy who, you know, specialize in Black queer studies and Black gay and lesbian life. And James Baldwin is the forerunner of that as well. He's like a godfather and a pioneer of the kinds of questions and discussions that had to be had publicly in this country and everywhere else.
Okay, well, Bill, congratulations on the book. It's called James Baldwin, Living in Fire. It's published in hardback by Pluto Books and costs £20 sterling, so about €23. The author, Bill V. Mullen. And Bill, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History, on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Donegal was the bastion of Home Rule conservative nationalism during the tumultuous period 1911 to 1925, while County Derry was a stronghold of hardline unionism. In this time of immense political upheaval between these cultural and social majorities lay the deeply symbolic, religiously and ethnically divided and potentially combustible Derry City. And a new book tells the story of the relationship between these two counties. The book is called Forging the Border, Donegal and Derry in Times of Revolution, 1911 to 1925. It's published in paperback by Irish Academic Press and costs €19.95. The author is Ocán Ollsecair. And Ocán, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Can we talk about the Ulster crisis, first of all? Because in those years up to the start of the First World War, people were looking at this region and thinking that this was where the next conflict in Ireland was going to break out.
Yes, a Times correspondent in 1914 wrote the Northwest was the most likely area of conflict in Ireland because you had nationalism and unionism recruiting the UVF, the Irish Volunteers, and the areas where nationals felt under threat had higher levels of recruitment. So the Northwest, particularly Eastern Donegal, Derry City, was seen as a potential flashpoint.
And it's interesting when you look at how partition became a huge controversial issue, and even the acceptance of a temporary idea of partition by the Irish Parliamentary Party was hugely destructive to its ambitions.
Yeah, I believe the acceptance of temporary partition by the Irish Parliamentary Party was more important than Easter Rising or the conscription scare and undermining its influence in the Northwest region. Even though the scheme would fall apart, the fact that its supporters knew that the Irish Parliamentary Party under Redmond's leadership was willing to accept temporary partition, which he thought would be temporary. Carson was told it would be permanent. Lloyd George was telling both men different things. This alarmed Northern Catholics that they thought that they were going to be betrayed, especially when they were told that they were fighting the First World War to secure home rule for the whole of Ireland. This led to the formation of the Irish National League, which was mainly a middle-class revolt against the Irish Parliamentary Party over partition. And many of them would find their way into Sinn Féin in 1917. And the Irish Parliamentary Party would have lost support from others as well, solely on this issue, because they lost the local press and many of the local clergy. Not all, but still significant at this time, how significant an issue it was, even though it was abandoned.
Can we talk about the War of Independence and what was going on in the Northwest? Because Donegal became very important as a staging post for attacks.
Yeah, in the War of Independence, Donegal was a periphery county. There was an overall lack of violence. Then in the Civil War, it becomes a staging post because it's a prime geographic location. Because of harsher legislation in the North, you have men from Derry City to owner Fermanagh crossing the border to seek refuge in Donegal. You have men from Cork and Kerry sent up to try to initiate a northern offensive. Collins, among others, wanted to try to maintain IRA unity under a time of great stress. So these mixture of fighters come into Donegal. However, planning wasn't great. There seemed to be a lack of communication on how this would all work. So it led to conflict between the Free State forces and the anti-treaty forces. Considering that Donegal was 90% pro-treaty, they didn't like the idea of outsiders coming in and fighting against them. It tended to happen instead of a joint offensive. So that led to a lot of anger. Then a lot of the local population wouldn't help the outsiders. They became disillusioned. And Pedrago and Balik, where there was a standing conflict with the British Army, that was a big chance for unity among Free States and anti-treaty forces. But it never really developed. There's some signs, but it never really developed because there's been so much bad blood between the pro-treaty and anti-treaty forces because there have been fatalities in previous battles in Donegal before that. So they can never agree who was in power. And then after that, then the treaty forces just overtook the irregulars and it was an inevitable victory for the pro-treaty side in Donegal.
And throughout this time, Derry was a city where there were fears that it could just go up in violence and go up in flames at any time.
In 1920, Derry City exploded. You had ex-servicemen who, without sanction, the UVF, started a conflict in response to fears of a nationalist corporation for the first time in Derry. This led to a conflict which killed 19 people. After a week, both sides kind of panicked. Even the IRA and the UVF worked together to try to stop the conflict. Local community leaders, clergy, got together to try to prevent further conflict. Because the city was considered a powder keg, conflict in the city, because the city is so small, could not be contained very easily, seeing how destructive it could be. By 1922, the Special Powers Act, the Derry IRA kind of retreated in confidence after 1920 because they knew they were heavily outarmed and outgunned, and they were increasingly forced to go across the border for safe haven. And that's how they ended up in Donegal for the Civil War.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It's called Forging the Border, Donegal and Derry in Times of Revolution, 1911 to 1925. It's published in paperback by Irish Academic Press and costs €19.95. The author, Ocán Ossacair. And we'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Moscow in the late 1970s. One by one, CIA assets are disappearing. The perils of American arrogance, mixed with bureaucratic infighting, has left the country vulnerable to ultra-sophisticated Russian electronic surveillance. A new book tells of a time when Russian spycraft was proving itself far ahead of the best technology the United States had to offer. It's a story of unorthodox underdog intelligence officers who fought an uphill battle against their government to prove that the KGB had pulled off the most devastating and thorough penetration of US national security in history. The book is called The Spy in Moscow Station, A Counter-Spy's Hunt for a Deadly Cold War Threat. It's published in paperback by Icon Books and costs £12.99 sterling, so about €15. The author is Eric Hasseltine. And Eric, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
It's great to be here.
It is an extraordinary story. And, you know, the book could have been sold as fiction. It's that enthralling and it's that breathtaking. Can you tell me what happened in the 1970s? Because it's not only a story of Russian penetration, it's also a story of American security agencies falling out with themselves and not trusting each other.
Well, you can think of it as an origin story for what's happening now with Russian meddling in the American elections and possibly in politics in the UK as well. And what happened was the Russians got extremely aggressive and penetrated an extremely sensitive area. We found out what they were doing, argued about it, pointed fingers, blamed each other. And in the end, they got great intelligence and got us to tear ourselves apart. And that might sound familiar. And so that's really why the story is important, because we taught them how to treat us, which is the worst that can happen if you lean way forward and take risks is that America will tear itself apart. But what happened was in the late 1970s, 1977 leading into 1978, American assets, which are humans, we call them human assets or human, that we were recruiting in Moscow and other parts of Russia to steal secrets for us, were getting what we call rolled up. They were being arrested, tortured, executed in large numbers, so much so that CIA director Stansfield Turner shut down all intelligence operations in Moscow. And the CIA chief of station suspected that the problem was a leak in the Moscow embassy where intelligence operations were coordinated. And so in desperation, he reached across bureaucratic lines from CIA to NSA, which is like the UK's GCHQ, which does electronic intelligence. And they brought in this super sleuth. You can think of him as George Smiley with an engineering degree. And he was brought in to find the bug and stop the leak.
And his name was Charles Gandy.
His name was Charles Gandy.
This George Smiley with an engineering degree. And he did an extraordinary job. And at times you found the Russians trying to compromise him by sending beautiful women dressed in peasant garb, trying to seduce him.
Yeah. Well, we call this a honey trap in the business. The Russians call them a swallow if they're a female, or a raven if they're a male. They're sexual operatives. And, yeah, he had just gotten or was about to get an antenna that we discovered in the embassy and look at it to figure out what it was listening to, which might be the bug, when instead of getting the antenna, you got a knock at the door and there's this beautiful woman with this teeny little blouse and gorgeous who said, well, I need to come in because I left my clothes in here. Can we go into your bedroom? And she had a bottle of vodka. And yeah, we call that a honey trap. So yeah, the story has, you know, sex in it. It has danger. It has suspense. And above all, it has mystery. You know, how are they doing it? But another mystery is after he essentially figured out what was going on, the CIA, who is a different agency than NSA, and the State Department, which is like the foreign ministry, shut him down. They didn't want him to continue his investigation. And the question really is, why was his own government trying to stop him from doing this investigation that was getting our own spies killed?
And why was that? Was it purely a turf war where the CIA didn't want to look bad and they didn't want the NSA to score points by proving what was happening and causing embarrassment for them? Or was there something else happening?
Well, you know, in the intelligence business, when you see some bad behavior, you always have two possibilities: malice or incompetence. Usually it's incompetence, but it could be malice. I mean, we don't know really what was going on. At this time, there were moles in both the State Department and in CIA, moles being Russian operatives that were very high up in American intelligence. Were they the ones that were shutting this down? That's an interesting question. Or were they trying to cover up their incompetence? I think there's a third, though, in this case, which is what Gandhi found was so astonishing from a technology point of view that it looked like magic. And no one could believe that the Russians could be that good, because we couldn't do what he said they were doing to us. And to believe that these primitive, you know, they're like a first world power with a third world economy, which they are today, by the way. And so there's this arrogance that, no, they can't do that. Well, it turned out, yeah, they could do that. And so it actually took 6 years to get to the ultimate bottom of it and find the leak.
And it showed a technological superiority on the Russian side, the way they were able to plant bugs and the way they were able to use these various devices to compromise American intelligence.
Well, you know, that's true. And it's really interesting to think about how the Russians got better than anyone else in the world. And there are two reasons. You know, one is they have so little money. And you think, well, gee, that would make them less capable. But the opposite is true, because constraints and lack of money are a great stimulus of creativity. And so actually you find the most creative and innovative developments by people who don't have great resources. Think about where innovation comes from. It's startups that aren't big and established. But the second thing is the Russians had a strategy of getting really good at those things that were the West's weak spot. And one of them was a weak spot. It's a bureaucratic that we have CIA and State Department who host the embassies and NSA. They all hated each other. And by aiming technology right in the cracks of those three organizations, they aimed their strength at our weakness.
And talk to me about your own role, because Charles Gandhi told you this story and you were able to go through documents. You worked for the NSA as well. You were director of research there.
I was. I was associate director of the agency. Then later, I was the associate director of national intelligence. So I was the chief technology officer of U.S. intelligence. And I had also been a Russian cyber analyst for a three-letter agency as a contractor after I left government full-time. So I speak Russian, and I did a lot of analysis of Russian cyber capabilities. So that research really helped me with the book, because I was able to dig into blogs of former KGB officers who talked about what had happened. And
I was able to bring a perspective to the story that isn't typical.
And it's extraordinary when you can origin story. Is there a sense that you feel that lessons were not learned from what happened in the 1970s and that that is playing out with disastrous consequences today?
Well, yeah, you know, there's an old saying, those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. But it's funny, they're also doomed not to repeat the good things that happened if they don't study history. And, you know, Gandhi did some good things, but people no longer remember what it takes to do that. So absolutely, in America today, we're about as divided as we have ever been. And our intelligence services are called the deep state. You know, they're this kind of secret dark force that shapes events secretly and clandestinely, according to some in power. And so there has never been more distrust and alienation of the intelligence services from the people that they serve than there is now. And I think we have the Russians to thank for it in that, you know, it's like a bee sting. That isn't what makes you sick. It's the way your system fights itself that makes you sick.
Okay.
And that's what we've done. We've taken this attack and we've turned it into something that is much worse.
The book is called The Spy in Moscow Station, A Counter-Spy's Hunt for a Deadly Cold War Threat. The author, Eric Hasseltine. And Eric, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Well, my thanks to Eric Hasseltine to join me tonight to talk about an extraordinary story. The book is called The Spy in Moscow Station, A Counter-Spy's Hunt for a Deadly Cold War Threat. It's published in paperback by Icon Books and costs $12.99 sterling, so about €15. And I'm afraid that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, my wonderful producer, Susan Cahill, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we're looking at the life and legacy of Polybius, and we'll be finding out how a Greek politician and general became one of the most influential historians of the ancient world. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.